A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. In recent episodes, we have looked at some of the wonderful professions and people that have dedicated their lives over the course of human history and modern human efforts to help others live better, more productive lives. We know about some of the classic people involved in this field. We might think about psychotherapists. We just did, or are doing as I record this, an episode about occupational therapists, which we are calling the most misunderstood field in healthcare. So I don't want to detract from what we're going to talk about in that episode and this one, but I want to talk about for today specifically the field of life coaching, because it's one of those things that sounds, I guess, very, very broad, and that maybe has people a bit confused, because we're used to evaluating, if we're looking at something like therapy, for example. You might say, well, there's even there, it's kind of a bit of a minefield, right? We have people who are social workers, people who have PhDs in therapy. And that, to me, always seems a little overkill. You're like, I'm not sure you need a doctorate to actually just help me with what I'm working on. But there are different levels of credential and different approaches that make the process of trying to find someone who can help you for whatever your specific need is quite complex. Another personal objection that I would have had when looking at, you know, specific challenges, let's say if we take career coaching, and I might say, I don't really want a classic therapist for this, or I would personally feel like therapy is the wrong venue for career coaching to be delivered. And I've had this argument with a friend who says that no, if you can figure yourself out and, you know, let's say you're struggling with imposter syndrome, that therapy is the right venue. My response would be sure, but you should decouple, you know, that conversation about imposter syndrome from dealing with a career coach who's a pragmatic brass tack specialist dealing with resume, presentation, the rest of it. I would see it more logical to break those things up. Now, when it comes to life coaching, it's, to my mind, just the most confusing of everything, because I guess as these professionals tend to be quite expensive, if you're not getting them subsidized especially, you want to make sure that you're spending your money on something that is effective, ideally a methodology that is clinically validated, that you're not going to be wound up in a even a helpful relationship indefinitely and far beyond what you can afford. So I'd love to talk today about what exactly life coaching is, where it fits in this panoply of helping professions, and what kind of credentials do we want to be looking for? Would you advise someone to look for if they were looking for some help in this regard? And when you're kind of doing these messy searches on the internet as a layperson, and you might see a mixture of life coaches, social workers, and psychologists, where do you even start in making sense of who's best equipped and best placed to help you if you can afford it and if you have coverage to do so? Because sometimes that's the guiding factor. But if we were in our hypothetical universe here to put money out of the picture for a second, and you were purely making these selections based upon fit and merits, what would you recommend as the kind of way to evaluate and make these decisions?
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking what life coaching actually is, where it fits among the helping professions, what credentials matter, and how a layperson is supposed to navigate a search that throws up life coaches, social workers, and psychologists all in the same results page. He mentions that if you strip money and insurance out of the equation and just evaluate on fit and merits, where do you even start?
He's right that it's confusing. I mean, I'm a retired physician, I've spent decades in clinical settings, and even I have to pause and squint at some of the websites out there. The terminology is all over the place.
Before we dive in, quick note. DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today. There, done. Moving on.
So let's start with the most basic question. What is life coaching? Because the answer is both simple and maddeningly slippery. At its core, life coaching is a forward-focused, action-oriented partnership where a coach helps a client clarify goals, identify obstacles, and create accountability structures to move toward those goals. It is not therapy. It is not clinical treatment. It does not diagnose or treat mental health conditions. The International Coaching Federation, the I, which is the largest credentialing body in the field, defines coaching as partnering with clients in a thought-provoking and creative process that inspires them to maximize their personal and professional potential.
That definition is doing a lot of work. Thought-provoking and creative process. I mean, you could say that about a good dinner conversation.
You could, and that's part of the problem. But the I has actually put real structure around this. They have a code of ethics. They have core competencies. They have 3 levels of credential. Associate Certified Coach, Professional Certified Coach, and Master Certified Coach. Each requires a specific number of training hours, coaching experience hours, and mentor coaching. The top tier, Master Certified Coach, requires 200 hours of coach-specific training, 2,500 hours of coaching experience, and 10 hours of mentor coaching.
There is a real framework. The question is, how many people calling themselves life coaches actually engage with it?
And that's the first big thing Daniel needs to understand. Life coach is not a protected term. Anybody can put up a website tomorrow and call themselves a life coach. No license required, no board certification required, no state regulatory body. Contrast that with psychologist, which in all 50 states requires a doctoral degree, supervised clinical hours, and passing a national exam plus a state jurisprudence exam. Or licensed clinical social worker, which requires a master's degree, thousands of supervised hours, and a clinical license. Those are protected titles backed by state law. Life coach is the Wild West.
Which makes it sound like you're saying just avoid life coaches entirely and go to a licensed professional. But I know you're not saying that, because you've actually recommended coaches to people.
And I'll explain why. But first, let's map the landscape properly, because Daniel asked where life coaching fits in the panoply of helping professions. Think of it as a spectrum. On one end, you have clinical treatment, psychiatrists, psychologists, clinical social workers, licensed professional counselors. These folks diagnose and treat mental health conditions. They work with depression, anxiety, trauma, personality disorders. They take insurance. They're bound by HIPAA. They can lose their license if they mess up.
On the other end?
On the other end, you have consultants, advisors, mentors. Someone who comes in with specific domain expertise and tells you what to do. A financial advisor, a business consultant, a fitness trainer. They're not asking open-ended questions to help you discover your own path. They're saying, here's the plan, do this. Coaching sits in the middle, but it leans toward the consulting side in terms of forward focus and action orientation, while borrowing the questioning methodology from the therapeutic side. A good coach doesn't tell you what to do. They ask questions that help you figure out what you want to do, and then they hold you accountable for doing it. Core competencies emphasize things like active listening, powerful questioning, direct communication, creating awareness, designing actions, planning and goal setting, managing progress and accountability.
It's structured conversation with accountability, which honestly sounds valuable. I can see why people pay for it. But Daniel's question about clinical validation is the right one. If I'm spending my own money, and these folks are not cheap, I want to know there's evidence behind the method.
This is where the research picture gets interesting. There was a meta-analysis published in the Journal of Positive Psychology that looked at 17 randomized controlled trials of coaching across various domains. The overall effect size was significant. Coaching produced meaningful improvements in goal attainment, well-being, and reduced stress. But, and this is a big but, the quality of the studies varies enormously. Many are small, many lack active control groups, and there's a huge diversity in what exactly the coaching intervention was.
The evidence base exists, but it's thinner than what you'd want if you're comparing it to, say, cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety.
Cognitive behavioral therapy has decades of rigorous randomized controlled trials with active control groups, manualized treatments, and long-term follow-up. Coaching research is where psychotherapy research was maybe 30 or 40 years ago. There are some well-conducted studies showing positive effects, but the field hasn't coalesced around specific protocols the way clinical psychology has.
Which brings us to Daniel's very practical question. He's searching online. He sees a mix of life coaches, social workers, and psychologists. Where does he start?
Let me give a framework. First, figure out what the actual problem is. And I mean really figure it out, not just what you think it is. Daniel mentioned the career coaching example. He had a friend who said imposter syndrome belongs in therapy, not career coaching. And Daniel's response was that you should decouple those. I actually think they're both partly right and partly wrong.
Okay, unpack that.
If someone has clinically significant imposter syndrome that's causing functional impairment, they're avoiding opportunities, they're experiencing anxiety attacks before presentations, their sleep is disrupted. That's therapy territory. That's a clinical issue. But if someone has garden variety self-doubt that's making them procrastinate on updating their resume or negotiate too timidly on salary, a skilled career coach can absolutely work with that. The key is severity and functional impact. The problem is that many people can't self-assess that accurately.
The first filter is clinical versus non-clinical. If there's a chance this is clinical, start with a licensed professional who can assess properly.
And here's a practical heuristic. If the issue you want to work on is primarily about your past, processing old wounds, understanding patterns rooted in childhood, healing from trauma, you want a therapist. If the issue is primarily about your present and future, setting goals, building habits, navigating a career transition, improving your leadership skills, coaching might be appropriate. And if you're not sure, start with a licensed clinician who can help you figure it out.
That's a clean heuristic. Past equals therapy, present and future equals coaching. But I imagine there's a messy middle.
There absolutely is. And that messy middle is where a lot of the confusing search results Daniel described come from. You'll find licensed therapists who also offer coaching services. You'll find coaches who have a master's in counseling but aren't licensed. You'll find social workers doing career counseling. The boundaries are porous.
How do you evaluate someone in that messy middle? Daniel specifically asked about credentials.
Let me walk through the credential landscape. For coaching, the gold standard is the I. There are other bodies, the International Association of Coaching, the European Mentoring and Coaching Council, but I is the largest and most rigorous. If someone has an I credential at the PCC or MCC level, they put in serious training and supervised hours. The Associate Certified Coach is the entry-level I credential and requires 60 hours of training and 100 hours of experience. That's not nothing, but it's also not a lot.
For the clinical side,
licensed psychologist, that's a doctoral degree, typically 5 to 7 years of graduate training, plus a year of supervised clinical internship and postdoctoral hours. Licensed clinical social worker, master's degree, 2 to 3 years, plus thousands of supervised clinical hours. Licensed professional counselor, similar, master's level with supervised hours. Board certified psychiatrist, medical degree, plus 4 year psychiatric residency. These are all serious, regulated credentials with teeth.
If I'm looking at someone's website and they have an alphabet soup of letters after their name, which ones actually mean something?
The ones backed by state licensure boards, PhD or PsyD with a state license, with a state license, with a state license, with board certification in psychiatry. Those you can verify through state licensing board websites. For coaching credentials, I has a public directory where you can verify someone's credential status.
If someone has none of those, just says life coach with a certification from some institute you've never heard of.
That doesn't mean they're bad. Some excellent coaches are uncredentialed or hold credentials from smaller organizations, but it means you have to do more due diligence. Ask about their training. How many hours? What was the curriculum? Who supervised their coaching? Ask for references. A good coach will be transparent about all of this. Someone who gets defensive when you ask about their training is a red flag.
Daniel also raised the cost issue, and I think this is where a lot of people get stuck. Therapy is often covered by insurance. Coaching almost never is. So you're paying out of pocket, and rates are all over the place.
There's a global coaching survey every few years. The most recent data shows average hourly rates for coaching in North America running somewhere between $150 and $350 an hour, depending on specialty and experience. Executive coaches working with C-suite clients can charge $500 an hour or more. That is real money. And because it's not covered by insurance, there's no third party negotiating rates down.
Which means the financial incentive structure is completely different from therapy. A therapist's income is constrained by insurance reimbursement rates. A coach can charge whatever the market will bear. And that creates an incentive to keep clients in the relationship indefinitely, which is something Daniel specifically flagged as a concern.
That's a legitimate concern. A well-structured coaching engagement should have a defined scope and a defined endpoint. Good coaches will propose a specific number of sessions up front, say 12 sessions over 6 months, with clear goals and a clear off-rep. If someone is pitching you an open-ended retainer with no defined outcomes, that's a warning sign. Not necessarily a deal-breaker, but a warning sign.
Therapy can also go on indefinitely, but the clinical justification is different. You're treating a condition that may require ongoing management. Coaching isn't treating a condition.
And that's why coaching ethics codes emphasize that coaches should refer out when they detect clinical issues. Code of Ethics explicitly states that coaches must recognize when a client needs mental health treatment and refer them to appropriate professionals. A coach who tries to handle clinical depression or an anxiety disorder is practicing without a license, essentially.
Here's the thing. How many coaches actually do that? I mean, when you're paying someone $300 an hour and they tell you you need to see a therapist instead, that's them voluntarily giving up revenue. The incentive is to keep you on.
That's where credentialing and ethics training actually matter. Credentialed coach has been trained on ethical referral and can lose their credential for ethical violations. An uncredentialed coach has no such accountability. So if Daniel is purely evaluating on fit and merit, I'd say credential is a strong signal, not because the letters guarantee quality, but because they signal that this person has voluntarily subjected themselves to an external ethical framework with consequences.
Let's talk about the specific scenario Daniel raised. He said he doesn't want a therapist for career coaching, and he wants to decouple imposter syndrome from the practical stuff like resume presentation. I think he's right about the decoupling, but I want to hear your take.
I think he's mostly right, with one caveat. The practical stuff, resume optimization, interview preparation, salary negotiation strategy, networking tactics, that's pure coaching or even consulting territory. You want someone who knows the job market, knows what recruiters are looking for, and can give you specific actionable feedback. A therapist probably isn't the right person for that unless they have specific career counseling training. The caveat is that sometimes the practical stuff is blocked by deeper stuff that the client doesn't recognize. You can have the most polished resume in the world, but if you're self-sabotaging in interviews because of unexamined beliefs about your own worth, the resume isn't the issue. A skilled career coach should be able to work with the surface-level manifestations of that, help you practice interview responses, build confidence through preparation. But if the blockage is deep, they should be able to recognize that and suggest therapy. The ideal scenario is having both, working on different layers of the same problem.
The decoupling is smart from a practical standpoint, but the client needs to be aware that these things can interact, and a good coach will flag that interaction.
And this connects to something important about how to choose. When Daniel is evaluating a potential coach, he should ask them directly, how do you handle it when a client's goals seem blocked by emotional or psychological patterns? A good answer is something like, I work with the client on the patterns that show up in the coaching context, but if I sense something deeper that needs clinical attention, I'll have a direct conversation about it and help with the referral. A bad answer is, oh, I can handle all of that, no problem, I've got techniques for everything.
Overconfidence is a red flag.
In any helping profession, overconfidence is a red flag. The best practitioners I know, therapists, coaches, physicians, are the ones who are clearest about the limits of their competence.
Let's get really concrete for Daniel. He's staring at a search results page. He sees 5 profiles. One is a licensed psychologist who also does coaching. One is an I, master certified coach with no clinical license. One is a licensed clinical social worker who does career counseling. One is a life coach with a certification from an institute he's never heard of. One is someone with no credentials listed at all but glowing testimonials. Walk me through how to rank these.
This is the exact scenario people face, and it's maddening. Here's how I think about it. First, eliminate the no credentials person unless you have a direct personal referral from someone you trust deeply. Testimonials on a website are easily curated. Anyone can get 5 friends to write glowing reviews, Without credentials or a trusted referral, you have no way to assess quality.
That narrows it to 4.
Next, the unknown certification. Ask yourself, am I willing to do the work to verify this certification? Can I find out how many training hours it required, whether there was supervised practice, whether there's an ethics code and a complaint process? If the answer is no, or if the research turns up nothing solid, I'd eliminate that one too. Life's too short to gamble on unverifiable credentials.
Down to 3. The psychologist who coaches, the iMaster certified coach, and the clinical social worker.
Now it depends entirely on the specific issue. If there's any chance, the issue has a clinical dimension, and I'd argue that for many people seeking life coaching, there's at least a subclinical dimension of anxiety, low mood, or self-esteem issues. I'd lean toward the psychologist or the social worker. Both can assess clinically. Both can shift into a coaching frame when appropriate. Both are bound by licensure ethics. The social worker might bring a particularly practical, systems-oriented perspective, which is valuable for career and life transition issues.
The master certified coach.
If the issue is purely performance oriented, I'm already functioning well. I want to function at an elite level. I want an accountability partner to push me toward ambitious goals. The M coach is an excellent choice. That level of I. Credential represents serious training and thousands of hours of experience. They're specialists in the coaching methodology specifically, which is distinct from therapy.
The decision tree is clinical dimension present or possible, go licensed clinician who also coaches, purely performance or goal, attainment focus with no clinical dimension, go credentialed coach.
That's the framework. But I want to add something that often gets overlooked. The quality of the relationship matters enormously. The research on psychotherapy outcomes consistently shows that the therapeutic alliance, the quality of the relationship between therapist and client, is one of the strongest predictors of success, often stronger than the specific therapeutic modality. I see no reason to think coaching is different. You can have the most impeccably credentialed professional in the world, but if you don't click with them, if you don't feel understood and challenged in the right way, it won't work.
Part of the evaluation has to be chemistry, and that's hard to assess from a website.
Which is why most good coaches and therapists offer a free initial consultation. 15 to 30 minutes, usually by phone or video, use that time. Don't just let them pitch you. Ask them the questions we've been discussing. How do they handle the boundary between coaching and clinical issues? What does a typical engagement look like? How do they measure progress? What happens if you're not seeing results? Pay attention to how they answer. Do they seem thoughtful? Do they admit uncertainty? Do they ask you good questions in return? If they spend the whole time selling you, that's a bad sign.
The sales pitch energy is a red flag in a helping profession.
It really is. And coaching has more of a problem with this than therapy, precisely because it's an unregulated market. There are coaches out there who are essentially salespeople with a coaching veneer. They'll promise transformation, breakthrough, your best life, all the buzzwords, and some of them charge 5 figures for a package.
Daniel mentioned not wanting to get wound up in a helpful relationship indefinitely far beyond what you can afford. The sales pitch coach seems like exactly the type who'd structure things that way.
And that's why I tell people, be wary of anyone who asks for a large upfront payment for a long-term package before you've had a chance to work together for a few sessions. Some legitimate coaches do offer packages with a discount for upfront payment, and that's not inherently sketchy. But if someone is pressuring you to commit to a year before you've done a single session, walk away.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said that I think gets at a deep attention. He mentioned that even within therapy, the different levels of credential, social worker versus PhD psychologist, seem like overkill. Like, do you really need a doctor to help you with what you're working on? And I think that question connects to a broader issue about how we think about helping professions. There's a tendency to think that more credential equals better help. And that's not necessarily true. A PhD psychologist has more training than a licensed clinical social worker. But if your issue is navigating a difficult workplace dynamic, the social worker might actually be more practical and helpful. The PhD spent years learning research methods and advanced assessment techniques that may be irrelevant to what you need. The credential is a floor, not a ceiling.
That's well put. And it applies even more strongly to coaching. Master certified coach credential is rigorous, but it's rigorous in coaching, not in clinical psychology. If you're comparing a master certified coach and a licensed psychologist for a purely coaching-oriented goal, the coach might actually be better equipped. They've spent thousands of hours specifically practicing the coaching methodology. The psychologist might default to therapeutic patterns that aren't what the client needs.
Fit isn't just about the credential level. It's about the match between the professional's training and the specific problem.
And that's why Daniel's instinct to decouple things is smart. Not because therapy and coaching can't coexist, they absolutely can, but because you want the right tool for each layer of the problem. A career coach for your resume, a therapist for your imposter syndrome, and ideally they're communicating with each other, or at least aware of each other's work.
That ideal scenario. Coordinated care across a coach and a therapist. How common is that in practice?
The structures don't support it. Therapists operate in a healthcare system with HIP, AA, insurance, treatment plans. Coaches operate in a private pay market with none of that infrastructure. There's no standard mechanism for a coach and a therapist to coordinate care. It happens when individual professionals make it happen, but it's not systematized.
Which means the burden falls on the client to manage the integration, and the client is the least equipped person to do that.
That's the reality, and it's one of the structural problems with the current landscape. If I could wave a magic wand, I'd create a clear pathway for coaches to refer to therapists and vice versa, with standardized release of information forms and care coordination protocols. But we're nowhere near that.
Given all of this, if Daniel or a listener is trying to make this decision, what's the practical bottom line? Let's synthesize.
Step 1. Define the problem as specifically as you can. Is there a clinical dimension? Significant distress? Functional impairment? Symptoms that might meet criteria for a diagnosis? If yes, start with a licensed mental health professional. Step 2. If the problem is primarily future-focused and goal-oriented, look for a credentialed coach. Credential at the PCC or MCC level is the strongest signal. Step 3. Verify credentials. Check state licensing boards for clinicians. Check the iDirectory for coaches. Step 4. Do initial consultations with 2 or 3 people. Ask them the hard questions we've discussed. Trust your gut on chemistry. Step 5. Define success up front. What would be different in your life after 3 months, 6 months? If the professional can't articulate how you'll know it's working, that's a problem.
The money question. Daniel said put money aside for the hypothetical, but in reality, money is never aside.
In reality, insurance covers therapy and doesn't cover coaching. So if you have good mental health benefits, starting with a licensed therapist who also does coaching, adjacent work is often the most cost-effective path. Many therapists are happy to work in a more coaching-oriented mode if that's what the client needs, as long as there's no clinical condition requiring treatment. You just have to ask them directly, do you do coaching-style work for clients who don't have a clinical diagnosis? Some do, some don't, some will do it, but can't bill insurance for it, so it becomes out of pocket anyway.
That last point is important. Even if you see a therapist, if the work isn't medically necessary treatment for a diagnosed condition, they can't ethically bill it to insurance, so you might end up paying out of pocket either way.
And at that point, the cost difference between a therapist's out-of-pocket rate and a coach's rate may narrow considerably. Therapists in private practice who don't take insurance often charge comparable rates to coaches.
One more thing I want to touch on. Daniel mentioned that life coaching seems like the most confusing of everything because it's so broad, and I think that breadth is both a feature and a bug. It's a feature because it means coaching can be applied to almost any life domain. Career, relationships, health, creativity, leadership, parenting, finances. It's a bug because almost anything can be called coaching, and there's no clear way to know if someone is qualified in the specific domain you need help with.
That's why specialization matters. If you're looking for career coaching, find someone who specifically does career coaching, not a general life coach who also does career, relationships, spirituality, and executive functioning. Survey data shows that coaches who specialize tend to have better outcomes and higher client satisfaction. It makes intuitive sense. You get deep expertise rather than shallow breadth.
The generalist life coach is a little bit like the general practitioner who also does surgery and dermatology and cardiology. You wouldn't trust that.
You absolutely wouldn't. And yet people hire life coaches who claim to handle everything from career transitions to marital problems to fitness goals. The scope is implausibly broad.
Specialization is another filter. When you're looking at someone's website, do they do one thing or do they do everything? If they do everything, be skeptical.
Be very skeptical. A good professional knows what they're good at and what they're not good at, and they're explicit about it.
Let's talk about the international dimension briefly. Daniel is in Jerusalem. The credentialing landscape varies by country, is global, but not all countries recognize it equally.
In Israel, the coaching field is fairly developed. There's the Israel Coaching Association, which is affiliated with the I. There are local training programs. But the same caveats apply. Coach is not a protected title in Israel any more than it is in the U.S. Psychologists in Israel are regulated through the Ministry of Health, and the title psychologist is protected. Social workers are regulated through the Ministry of Social Affairs. So the same basic framework we've been discussing applies, but Daniel should verify credentials through the relevant Israeli regulatory bodies for clinical professionals.
For coaches, the iDirectory is the most reliable cross-border verification tool.
Credential is internationally portable in a way that clinical licenses generally are not. A psychologist licensed in the U.S. can't necessarily practice in Israel without going through the local licensure process, but an iCredential is recognized globally.
All right. I want to push on one assumption that's been sitting under this whole conversation. We've been talking as if coaching and therapy are clearly distinct categories with a clean boundary between them. But you mentioned earlier that the boundary is porous, and I want to explore how porous it really is.
In practice, very. Many therapists incorporate coaching techniques. Many coaches draw on therapeutic frameworks. It self acknowledges that coaching can have therapeutic benefits even though it's not therapy. And there's a growing movement toward integrative practice where professionals are trained in both.
Is the distinction we've been drawing actually useful, or are we imposing a clarity that doesn't exist on the ground?
I think the distinction is useful as a conceptual framework, but you're right that on the ground it's messier. The key distinction isn't really about the techniques being used. Active listening, powerful questioning, goal setting, these show up in both. The key distinction is about the professional scope of competence and ethical obligations. A therapist has a legal and ethical duty to assess for clinical conditions, to diagnose when appropriate, to create treatment plans, to manage risk. A coach doesn't have those obligations. That difference matters even when the conversation looks similar from the outside.
It's not about what they're doing in the room. It's about what they're responsible for.
And that's why, if there's any ambiguity about whether an issue is clinical, you want someone who carries those responsibilities. Because if things go sideways, if the client has a crisis, if there's suicidal ideation, if there's a previously undetected trauma response, the therapist is trained and legally obligated to handle it appropriately. The coach may not be.
That's a compelling argument for starting with a licensed clinician and moving toward coaching if appropriate, rather than the reverse.
And it's the advice I'd give to anyone who's genuinely unsure. Start with the person who has the broadest scope of competence and the strongest ethical obligations. If it turns out you don't need clinical services, they can shift into a coaching frame or refer you to a coach. But if you start with a coach and it turns out you need clinical services, you've lost time and money and potentially made things worse.
Daniel, I hope this gives you a framework. It's not a simple answer. The landscape is confusing, but there are ways to navigate it. Define the problem, assess for clinical dimensions, verify credentials, do consultations, trust your gut on chemistry, and define success upfront. And if you're unsure, start with the licensed clinician.
I'll add one thing that we haven't said explicitly. There's nothing wrong with needing help. The fact that Daniel is asking these questions thoughtfully, trying to make a good decision about his own growth and development, that's a sign of strength, not weakness. Whether the right professional is a coach or a therapist or both, the impulse to seek support is healthy.
And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The national animal of Scotland is the unicorn. It has been since the 12th century, when it was used on the Scottish royal coat of arms. Scotland is one of the only countries in the world whose national animal is a mythological creature.
I respect the commitment to a bit that's lasted 800 years.
That's delightful.
Here's a forward-looking thought. The coaching industry is growing fast. The I estimates it's a multi-billion dollar global market now, and regulation is almost certainly coming. The question is what form it takes. Will states start licensing coaches? Will insurance eventually cover coaching for specific purposes? Will there be a standardized national exam? In 10 years, this conversation might sound completely different.
I suspect you're right. And the challenge will be designing regulation that protects consumers without stifling the flexibility and innovation that makes coaching valuable. It's a hard policy problem.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.